Thanks for joining us. Dr. Terry Walls discusses the challenges of gluten sensitivity with an extensive question and answer with the public about gluten and the Walls diet.
So,
how are you doing?
I know it's been an amazing couple of months. As I'm sure most of you know, my son's book came out, My Two Moms. And Jackie and I went out to be in New York City to have a lot of fun with that. Then on the day of the release, on the 26th, we flew Zebby out. So she came out to join us. We did the book release party, the reading, and she had to be there when we won Jon Stewart Daily Show. And yeah, that was really quite fun. When Zach was on his many TV appearances, what you get is the 6 to 10 minutes with the host. It's the only time you see the host. Otherwise, there's a handler that does the prep work beforehand, gets you on the set, escorts you off the set, back to the green room, and does rah-rah. What was quite remarkable was Jon Stewart popped in to chat with Zach before the... I wanted to reinforce how important that was. After the show, call it. What's that? My pleasure. So then handlers respond. Okay, we have more people coming. Who got it? That train is actually quite close to the
thing. Yeah, just across the street.
Yeah. So, Stuart, right after the show aired, these handlers came out and said, mothers, sister, come with me. And so they got us from the audience and took us back to the green room where we got to hang out with Zach and tell him how impressed we were with how well they had done the show. And the next thing we know, Jon Stewart pops in with his entourage and starts chatting with us, telling us how much he loved the book. Turns out Jon Stewart's wife just recently discovered that she's gluten sensitive. So they're going on a gluten-free diet, and John was commenting what a phenomenally good thing that was for him and his wife and his family. And they said, hey, I want some pictures. So then we all stood and got a bunch of photos with Jon Stewart, so that was really quite fun. So what do you think? Is it time to start?
Yeah, I know your thought. Yeah.
Okay. So is wheat your friend or foe? So for many people, it's going to turn out to be foe. So what I'm going to do today is tell you my story, talk a bit about why that may translate to many more than just me, and then we'll invite you to have a conversation, some Q&A with me. Now, for those of you who may not have heard my story, I'm a professor of medicine here at the University of Iowa. My clinical practice is over at the VA. And when I came to Iowa City, I got a welcome to Iowa City news that I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And I decided that I would go try and find the best MS center in the country, at least one that I could get to easily, and that turned out to be the Cleveland Clinic. So I went there, asked them for a second opinion. They said, yes, you have MS, and recommended that I take a disease-modifying drug. I took Copaxone, which is a daily injection, and the way it works is that it tricks your body to attack the Copaxone, in theory, instead of attacking your brain. And the goal is to decrease the number of acute worsening episodes known as relapses. And all of these drugs, Avonex, Betaseron, Copaxone, Rebif, will decrease the number of relapses that you can expect to have by about a third. So it's not perfect treatment, but it was the best that I could hope for. And so, of course, I started the Copaxone. I also began reading the medical literature, wanting to educate myself a bit more. And what I saw was very upsetting, because half of everyone who's diagnosed with MS within 10 years is unable to work because of severe fatigue. And a third within 10 years have problems walking, such they need either a brace, a cane, a scooter, or a tilt or climb wheelchair. Now, fortunately for me, I had been an athlete before going off to medical school. I had competed nationally in taekwondo in 1978. You know, my daughter says, "Mom, you are the ultimate badass." Because in 1978, I competed in the Pan American Trials in full contact taekwondo. And there was like no protective gear. We were just like totally into blood sports, so to speak. But I got into medical school. I thought, my God, I can't let people punch me and kick me in the head anymore. So I quit competing. I would just do classes and did some teaching. And I had then, during my residency, quit going to class. I would run and train on my own. And when I had my kids, I was still biking, running, and doing Nordic track. And I was doing this in home, as opposed to leaving my kids alone, of course. But remarkably, I really had not missed a day of working out. I was always either lifting weights, jogging on my treadmill, or doing Nordic track. So when I was diagnosed with MS, I understood that all of my prior athletic life was just a warm-up for what was my real challenge, which was, because now working out every day might mean the difference between being able to walk and still be relatively active. So I still worked out every day. I jogged as long as I could. Then I switched over to walking on my treadmill. And I also put in a endless pool, which is a wonderful device. It's a pool 15 by 10 feet, and there's a current generator that you flip on, and so it's like a swimmer's treadmill. So I would swim every day. I had dumbbells that I used to do weight strengthening exercises. And I was very fortunate. I had only one transient episode of weakness of my right arm. And so, from a treatment strategy, I was a phenomenal success in that I had only one relapse in 3 years. But my strength had continued to decline. Fatigue was a much bigger problem. My back muscles were very tired. In 2003, my internal medicine doc and my neurology doc said, you know, it's time for you to get a scooter. And then he changed his mind. So, well, maybe you should get a certified wheelchair because of the severe fatigue problems that you have. He also suggested that I take chemotherapy in the form of Novantro in an attempt to try and slow my decline. So I took the chemotherapy. I got the certified wheelchair. And it was also apparent to me that my future was likely to become even more profoundly disabled, and I would likely end up ultimately confined to bed. So I went back to reading the medical literature because I was no longer so frightened about the future. I knew how bad it might get, and it might be really, really bad. I also had reached the conclusion that conventional medicine was not able to stop my decline. That if I was going to have any success at being able to provide for my family, it was going to be up to me to find that. You see, basic science, I know, is 10 to 30 years ahead of clinical practice. And so I started reading basic science. I went to PubMed.gov and started doing my searches. The other thing I have to tell you is I'm a trained artist. My bachelor's degree is in a Bachelor of Fine Arts Studio Art Painting. I took the least number of science courses that I could. I had to ace them all and did really well at the MCAT, so I could get into medical school. So my first years of medical school, I was doing all that basic science, cellular physiology, biochem. I thought, oh my God, that was really, really hard. And I was so relieved when I was done and said, okay, I'm done. I'm not going to have to be keeping up with that stuff anymore. So now that I was reading the basic science, I had to relearn my basic science stuff. And I would also tell you that now science turns over every 5 years. And so all this stuff was new. I mean, either I'd never really, really paid attention. But there were so many things that were new concepts that I had to learn in the midst of my increasing MS-related brain fog. And what I found was that the animal models for MS didn't really talk much about mitochondria, but the other animal models of disorders with shrinking brains, things like Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's disease, they all were talking about mitochondria not working very well, leading to the early deaths of brain cells. And so I decided, you know, that might be part of the problem with MS too. And so I'm looking for research articles about how you resuscitate your mitochondria. Then I finally had this brilliant insight. Well, I should be reading it for drug studies because those drug studies would take forever to get approval. I should be reading studies about vitamins, supplements, things that I could actually access. And so I gradually identified a number of vitamins and supplements that were very good for protecting mouse mitochondria and their brains. I translated those mouse-sized doses into human-sized ones and began taking fish oil, creatine, coenzyme Q. What I observed was that the speed of my decline slowed. And I keep reading, I gradually add a few more vitamins and minerals. And in 2007, I discovered the Institute for Functional Medicine and learned more brain cell biology. Here's the quick point. You've got a billion brain cells, 10 trillion connections. All that connective wiring has to be insulated with something called myelin. To make myelin, you need the vitamins, fish oil, or omega-3, and iodine. And then to make the neurotransmitters, the molecules that your brain cells use to activate the next brain cell, again, you need B vitamins, some amino acids, and sulfur. What you need to make your mitochondria work really, really well are B vitamins, antioxidants, and sulfur. So I now had a very long list of vitamin supplements that I was taking. And the next brilliant insight I had was that I should look for the food sources for this list of 17 nutrients that I was taking. So that took more research to try and figure out the medical text didn't have it, the food science text didn't have it. The registered dietitians whom I consulted with, they didn't have it either. But the University of Google did. And so I gradually was able to organize a food plan that I could use to guide what I should eat every day. And the amazing thing, you know, I should tell you that in 2002, one of my neurologists suggested that I check out this fellow named Ashton Every, who was talking about following a paleolithic diet, hunter-gatherer, that you shouldn't eat soy, dairy, grain. And so I had already eliminated those things, but it wasn't very clear on what it was you should eat. So for years, I already had what they would call a fabulous diet. But when I organized things more intentionally around what I had learned about my brain cell nutrients, and that's what I came up with, and now is the time for audience participation. Are you ready? Mm-hmm. It's a plate full of greens. Now your turn. Plate full of greens.
Plate
A plate full of sulfur.
Plate
a plate full of sulfur, a plate full of carb, a plate full of carb, grass-fed meat, organ meat, seaweed. Okay, that is where the magic happens. And things you don't eat are going to be grains, potatoes, dairy, and soy. And when I made those changes, in a year's time, 1 year, after 7 years of steady decline, taking the best drugs from the very best people, I'm able to walk without a cane, walk throughout the hospital, begin biking again, and do an 18-mile bicycle ride with my family. So, big picture. Hang on to the microphone. So, very big picture. If we have the food allergies, sensitivity to gluten, wheat can be a huge problem. If you eat a lot of wheat, grains, potatoes, you're going to be stimulating the growth of the wrong bacteria in your bowels.
What about yams?
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll come back to that. You guys write down your questions, we'll get that filed in here for me. You'll be growing the starch-loving bacteria. And the starch-loving bacteria didn't live in our guts for the first 2.5 million years that humans were around. We started having grain, legumes, dairy, potatoes about 10,000 years ago. And over the last, and then 2,000 years ago, we started having white flour, about 300 years ago, white sugar, about 50 years ago, high fructose corn syrup. And the percent of calories devoted to starch has steadily increased. That fertilizes the wrong bacteria in your bowels. These bacteria, as they digest all that starch, will make a number of toxic compounds that will diffuse into your bloodstream and create problems for you. So the reason to avoid wheat, number one, you may have food allergies, and food allergies are, way too many physicians are clueless on food allergies. But the second reason is that the wheat, the grain, the potatoes, all that starch stimulate and fertilize the growth of sugar-loving bacteria and yeast that create toxic byproducts. So in my practice, I will tell people, I want you to go off wheat. I want you to severely restrict your use of even the non-gluten grains and starches to no more than 2 servings a week. Because I'm trying to change the growth of the bacteria that live in your bowels. I'm trying to get you to have the healthy mix, what I call the old friends, and to get rid of the troublemakers. Okay, so I'm going to start going through the questions, and we'll start with the question about vitamin D. Okay, so we're going to, for 2.5 million years, humans were in the sunlight 24/7. We had lots of vegetables and berries. And, you know, with the onset of the Industrial Revolution, we started spending more and more time inside. And then we invented sunscreen, and our dermatology doctors convinced us that we should avoid the sun because of the risk for skin cancer. We now have an epidemic of profound vitamin D deficiency. If your vitamin D in the labs, you get a normal vitamin D level from 20 to 70. We define that by testing thousands of people who live inside and use sunscreen, by the way. Find the average value and then go 2 standard deviations below and above to set the normal range. On the other hand, you know, I'm sort of a simplistic person. I'd rather pick the range based on what is the healthiest. So if you look at the epidemiology that says, where does the odds ratio favor good health over bad things like mental health problems, schizophrenia, depression, bipolar, cancers, heart disease, aortic abdominal aneurysms, preterm labor, preeclampsia, cancers. You know, I don't want any of those things. So the odds ratio when it flips over to favoring health is about 54 nanograms per mil. The other thing you do is look at pregnant moms who then deliver their babies and are breastfeeding. At what blood value for her vitamin D does the mom need to have her breast milk have enough vitamin D? That's 55. And then if you look at the people who live and work in the sun, and then their values range from 80 to 120. Now, if you get too much vitamin D, you can end up with delirium, psychosis, and renal failure. So too much vitamin D is a problem. In my practice, I tell people I'd rather they have a vitamin D between 50 and 100 nanograms per mil. And typically, people need 2,000 units plus a good tan during the summer, and 4,000 to 5,000 units a day during the winter. But anyone taking more than 2,000 units, so actually all of us, should have a vitamin D level twice a year to make sure you can keep that level between 50 and 100. Now, when you take vitamin D, you need to have more vitamin A and vitamin K. You get that by eating organ meats and greens. You can also get vitamin D by having fermented olive oil, which really is extremely tasty. Tongue-in-cheek, mind you. That's you have to be a real man or a real woman to have your spoonful of olive oil. Okay, what are the percent of good fat versus vegetable carbs versus protein? Paleo. What's the recommendation for healthy mix? You know, I'm sort of radical. I don't pay attention to the carbs, the fat, the protein. I'm much more interested in the micronutrients. So we're not into counting calories. In our study, I tell people you have a plateful of greens, a plateful of sulfur, a plateful of color, plenty of protein. And once you have healthy fats like coconut oil, you can use vegetable oils like flax oil, hemp oil, walnut oil, cold as part of a salad dressing. But you don't want to fry in vegetable oils because you will make trans fats. It will destroy many of the good, helpful antioxidants. So vegetable oils use cold, and you want an omega-3 rich oil on your dressings. If you're going to heat anything, I would use coconut oil or use clarified butter, as in ghee. And the reason I use clarified butter is that regular butter has too much of the milk protein casein. And that milk protein to your immune cells looks too much like gluten. You'll be much more likely to have problems with inflammation. Okay, a recent blood test. I was advised my B6 level was too high and I should stop taking B vitamins. Are high B6 levels problematic? Yes, they are. So anyone taking more than 100 milligrams of B6 should be monitoring the blood levels. A great source of B vitamins is liver from organic grass-fed animals. And ideally raw or rare, because as we cook the meat, we destroy the B vitamins. Yeah, and it's one of the hazards of any kind of vitamin or supplement regimen is that you may get things out of proportion in terms of how we use our vitamins and minerals is a very proportional thing in our body, because many of these receptors to take in that information works for multiple minerals and multiple B vitamins. So if you get one too high, for example, copper and zinc are closely related. If you take a lot of zinc, you'll make yourself copper deficient. And that's part of why I think targeted vitamins and supplements can be extremely helpful. But food. And you should not be eating processed foods, white flours, sugars, because that's going to give you a lot of calories and not many vitamins or minerals. In our study, we do let people have two non-gluten starches a week. And that makes things a little bit easier for socializing. So you can have your corn chips when you go out for the fajitas with your family, or you go to Mongolian Grill with your family. You can have some rice noodles there. But in our study, we limit that to two servings a week, and that seems to work out. If you have more than that, you're stimulating the growth of the troublemakers in your bowels. Any connection between thyroid disorder and celiac disease? Absolutely. Yeah, this is a great question. So gluten sensitivity, when I was in medical school, I was taught that if you had gluten sensitivity, your small bowels attacked, and you develop severe diarrhea with stinky poops that were sort of oily. The person would have severe weight loss and would look like the kids from Biafra. We now know that 95% of folks who have gluten sensitivity do not have a problem attacking their bowels. So they may have a normal bowel biopsy. The most common organ that is attacked is actually your thyroid. But you can also have your skin attacked, you can have some rashes, you can have your lungs attacked, you can have asthma, you can have your the lining of your sinus cells attacked and you end up with seasonal allergies. You can have your bones attacked and have osteoporosis. So gluten sensitivity just means that your immune cells are active against gluten and you will develop other antibodies attacking other structures in your body. The longer you keep eating gluten, the more cells types will be attacked and the more types of autoimmune diagnoses you'll develop. Food suggestions for thyroid disorders. You'd like to have enough iodine, so seaweed can be very helpful. Anyone who has a thyroid disorder who begins taking iodine in the form of seaweed will probably observe that their need for thyroid medication may change. They may need less. It is possible that some people have an overactive thyroid. And the reason you aren't in trouble is that you're severely iodine deficient. So when you begin taking iodine in the form of seaweed, you may discover that you have an excessively active thyroid. Okay. By reducing sugar, I accidentally reduce wheat and dairy. Yes, if you get rid of your processed foods. You know, and basically, wheat is in everything that's processed. So it comes in a jar, box, can. Unless it's labeled gluten-free, you really need to assume that it has been contaminated with gluten somehow during the process. Oddly, this has led to constipation. So, you know, occasionally we do have people that have problems with constipation. That is quite unusual, but it certainly can happen. In that circumstance, a simple solution is to use magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salts, and dissolve a teaspoon of that, or a tablespoon, or two tablespoons, in hot water and drink it. It'll taste sort of bad, really bad. And then chase it with some tea that you really enjoy. And you can titrate the amount of magnesium sulfate to get the amount of poop that you'd like to have. It is important that you poop every day. Is constipation or diarrhea a symptom of gluten intolerance? Actually, it is. Irritable bowel can be a symptom. You know, basically, not being well can be a symptom of food allergy. So I urge people, if you want to sort out, do I have gluten sensitivity, is to go meticulously off gluten and dairy for a couple of weeks. In general, I would wind that down over a week, wind up the green, sulfur, color, grass-fed meat, organ meat, seaweed over a couple of weeks. And when you had 2 weeks of the right diet, then you say, okay, time for a test. Then have a gluten meal and see how you feel. If you feel worse, I'd stay off it. Then you get the following week, you can have a meal with dairy. If you feel worse, stay off that. If you're still finding, after following the Walls diet, meticulously for a couple of weeks, you're not improving, then you may have other food allergies. And at that point, in my practice, I encourage you to go soy-free, potato-free, and do more of a paleo diet. Because you probably are, the problem may be that you're growing the wrong critters in your bowels. And what you need to do is starve out the bad boys and feed the good boys. How does this diet affect anxiety, excessive compulsive disorders, mental health problems? Okay. So, broken biochemistry is the root of all disease, every disease. And part of the root of these broken biochemistry is that we're missing the building blocks to do the chemistry correctly. And by the way, can someone tell me the time? We need to make sure I...
10:30.
Okay, good.
More or less.
Very good. So the mental health disorders are largely driven by the fact you can't make your myelin, but you can't make your neurotransmitters. So this diet will dramatically help giving you the building blocks. The third factor that can be a big factor in all these mental health problems are toxins from growing the bad boys in your bowels. And to fix that, you got to starve out the bad boys. So that means getting rid of the carbs. And you have to fertilize the good boys. That means lots of fiber. And so, in general, this diet has plenty of fiber, so about 50 to 80 grams. If you're still not pooping, you can take magnesium sulfate. You can take a fiber supplement of your choice. The goal is to poop every time you eat in a controllable fashion. We're not trying to give you diarrhea. Okay, we have more questions. We must have more questions.
Skip the yam.
Yam question, yes. So yams would be winter squash and gluten-free grains, like quinoa, for example. I would consider that to be a carb, and two servings a week is perfectly fine. Okay, now winter squash, it's sort of radical to think about giving up all that yummy food to have just two servings a week. That's a half cup twice a week. Now, the winter squash, you can get a spiralizer and make these tiny angel hair pasta noodles, and then put your tomato sauce over the spiralized winter squash, and you can have that as often as you like. Because when you don't cook it, the carbs are not quite as available, and you don't have as much worry about growing the wrong critters in your bowels. So I make angel hair pasta out of zucchini squash, winter squash, turnips, daikon radishes, and put a variety of red sauces over that. It's really quite lovely. Okay. On a side topic, can electrical stimulation in addition to diet change help you might recover? So in our clinical trial, we are copying everything that I did in that first year. And that includes this radical diet, some targeted vitamins and supplements, daily meditation, self-massage, an exercise program designed specifically for that person, and electrical stimulation. It is my perception that of all these things, diet and the vitamins are probably the most important. The meditation, massage, balances the stress hormones. That's also very important for lowering inflammation. The exercise, the E-stim, you want to get your muscles fast. And so that will accelerate that recovery. On my website, I encourage you to go to terrywalls.com. And go to the community resources page. There is a link there for the forum, and under forum you can see all sorts of questions that people got going. And we have hundreds of responses to how adapting walls diet has helped them out. And there's a wide variety of things that have been helped, from mental health disorders, other autoimmune disorders, and the general medical problems. And in my clinic, yes, I just use the diet and very limited vitamins and supplements. I see people losing weight without being hungry. I see blood pressures improving, cholesterol improving, autoimmune problems improving. More questions? Right. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about how much time it takes for you to prep your food and what are your tips?
Okay, so let's talk about food. So here's my typical day. In the morning, I make a berry coconut milk smoothie. And I'll have meat, whatever was left over from the night before. I also make my own jerky with organ meats, heart, gizzards, and liver. So, one thing at a time, one thing at a time. Okay, so that's my breakfast, that's my lunch. My evening is a big plate of greens, either raw or cooked, more meat. And then I'll have probably another vegetable such as Brussels sprouts, green beans, asparagus, and for dessert I'll have berries or an orange, and that's some variation thereof. I use a Vitamix to make smoothies and to blend soups. I make a big salad, and then for the meat I'll put a tablespoon of coconut oil, a little bit of water, a variety of spices, and then meat in my skillet, and I'll cook that for 10 to 15 minutes. Occasionally longer, but generally not much more than 15, so it might be fairly rare. Then I slice it up and serve that, a big salad, and whatever steak and vegetables that I have. I wasn't going to spend $400 for a Vitamix. I thought that was just an outrageous waste of money. So I used up my blender until it died, then I got the Vitamix. I thought, man, why did I wait so long? I just love my Vitamix. There are other high-powered blenders, such as HealthMaster, which I hear is very good as well. But so I use it for blenders. When they're done, look for a high-powered blender, such as HealthMaster or Vitamix, and it's very helpful. More questions? oh, the jerky. How do I make jerky? So I take the meat, put some vinegar with it. So a pound of liver, a couple tablespoons of vinegar, a teaspoon of sea salt, a teaspoon of kelp, plus whatever spices you like. And I like things spicy, so I put in 2 teaspoons of black pepper. Sometimes I put in curry, sometimes not. And then I let it marinate in my refrigerator for at least 24 hours. Then I will dehydrate it in my dehydrator at the lowest temp until it's chewy. Now, because I do this at a lower temp, the food is more equivalent to being raw. So I have to be very careful about source. So I want to be sure that I'm getting it from an organic farmer that's not using confinements and antibiotics. And you have to know that the animal is quite healthy. You can make jerky using your oven at 170 degrees, 180, and that will kill the bacteria and the parasites, so from a public health standpoint, that will be safer. The length of time that you have to roast your jerky, you just have to roast it long enough so that it's at the chewiest level that you want. I soak everything in vinegar and salt to help kill the bacteria, parasites, and other stuff. But from a public health standpoint, you may want to do it at 170 degrees, 180 degrees to decrease the risk of parasites, bacteria, etc. Yes?
If it is labeled organic, like organic chicken livers,
yes.
What would you, knowing that it was safe, go ahead and...
So I use a lot of wild game. I will use the organic organ meats that are found here, and I do a lot of the organic livers, and I dehydrate at the lowest temperature to keep it more on the raw side.
105.
Now, the other thing that I do with my organ meats, I'll, again, use coconut oil, lots of mushrooms, lots of onions, and put my liver with that, with a tablespoon or so of wine, and simmer it again 10 to 15 minutes. I want it to be on the rare side, and then we'll eat it. And then whatever's left over, I will mix in my food processor, either with the clarified butter or coconut oil, and make pâté. And I'll eat that then for my breakfast as well. The organ meats are your most concentrated sources of B vitamins, minerals, and good essential fats. You want to be sure that they're grass-fed, they're organ meat, grass-fed and organic, because all those toxins that we eat get stored in our fat and in our organ meats. So you'd rather not have those toxins, so you want organic sources for all of your meat. Because all the fat in that meat, which makes it so tasty for us, is filled with toxins if you have factory-farmed meat.
What if you don't eat meat?
So I know there are a number of folks who are spiritually very uncomfortable eating meat. I was a vegetarian for many, many years, I think about 20. And when you're a vegetarian, you're much more likely to grow the wrong bacteria, the troublemakers in your bowels. And you're more likely to have things called phytic acids and lectins. So I invite people who are vegetarians to evaluate the possibility of eating animal proteins. If people spiritually cannot bring themselves to do that, the next option is to sprout the grain and the legumes, soak them in water for 24 hours, rinse all that off, soak another 24 hours. That will decrease the lectins, decrease the carbohydrates, and will make those foods far safer. And depending on the person's health circumstances, that might be enough. If the person has an autoimmune problem, again, I invite them to think deeply about why they're choosing to be vegetarian, and invite them to reconsider eating meat. For me, it was a very big deal to go back to eating meat after 20 years of not eating meat. My dad, who was a farmer, kept saying, "This is going to kill you, Terry. You need to be eating meat." Now, unfortunately, both my parents had died before I went back to eating meat. But I thought they must have been rolling in their graves. My dad, I'm sure, was saying, "I told you, I told you, I told you, I told you." So, Papa John, I'm so sorry, you were so right. Yes.
Grains, what grains are?
Okay, so all grains. So in the Walls Diet Plan, if you read my book, Mighty by Mitochondria, I presume that most of us are going to make this change incrementally. And in my clinic, I stress 9 cups of fruits and vegetables. If you do that, that cuts out, because you'll be full, a lot of the bad stuff. Level 2, gluten-free, dairy-free, and if anyone has a chronic health problem, I strongly urge that. Level 3 is going paleo, using the Walls Diet. So that means no grain, no dairy, no legumes. And depending on one's health circumstances, level 1, more vegetables might be enough. Level 2, gluten-free, dairy might be enough. And for vegetarians, that certainly is a possibility. And in my practice, the way I practice this, I lay out, here are the reasons for eating this way, and here's how you want to get the greens, sulfur, grass-fed meat, or you need seaweed. And then I say, so we're going to learn what you're going to do. And if people think whatever choice they're going to make, I may encourage them when they're ready to go to the next higher level. But you all charge your own lives. So you make the choice that spiritually feels right for you. You stay in contact. And if your health doesn't improve far enough, I encourage you to keep moving along. Yes. So seafood and fish, I put that in the term of wild grass-fed. So wild seafood is better than farmed seafood for the same reason that wild grass-fed meat is better than farmed meat or corn-fed meat. But interesting study that looks at the carbon footprint. When a plant takes carbon dioxide out of the air and puts it into their structure, it does in a unique way that can be seen by mass spectrometer. So every plant has a signature on carbon. And that signature stays as it goes through the animal food chain. So, you know, we've got a lot of corn in Iowa. I invite people to throw out some numbers as to what percent of your carbon has the corn footprint. Let's just throw out some numbers here.
90%,
not quite that high. It goes between 55 and 60. That's pretty amazing, really. Particularly now that corn is 85% genetically modified, and the health consequences of the genetic modification that increases the risk for food allergies. And in the limited animal studies of genetic modification, that increases the risk of infertility. Such that after 3 generations of these studies, the animals were infertile. That's a big issue. Yes?
That's what I wanted to ask you about. I have a 20-year-old daughter who's hormone girl.
So we'll talk briefly about hormones. So the plastics, the pesticides will stimulate the hormone receptors. It will confuse the estrogen, the thyroid, the testosterone, and the stress hormones in our body, getting us all out of whack. It increases the probability of diabetes, obesity, fertility issues. Unrecognized gluten sensitivity is much more common in those who have these hormone problems. My advice, go on the Walls Diet and go fully paleo. Be very, very strict about organic. Get plastics out of your life. And keep your personal health products organic, green. If you take a shower every day and you use soap under your armpits, you don't need deodorant. Particularly if you're eating organic foods. Okay, yes?
Have any of your studies at all focused on children?
So the only clinical study that I have is with secondary progressive MS. We have 8 of 10 people with marked improvement at 1 year. Very exciting. We're now adding primary progressive MS to that population. I've got a handful of people in. We've not seen them back for their 3 months. Just in the phone conversations with them, these people are very excited, and they have the perception that their energy is improving, their mental clarity is improving. My clinical practice is adult vets at the VA. I certainly anticipate when I look at how bad the diet is for our children, that having the Walls diet going organic will have a profoundly helpful impact on the kids. When I look at my own personal circumstances, my kids have problems with asthma, allergies, and mental health issues, which go away when they follow the diet. And you can look at my son, and if you look closely at his forehead, you'll see he's following the diet or not, because acne will pop up on his forehead when he's having indiscretions. And he comes back and says, you know, he so wishes that he had an acute, severe problem. My daughter gets terrible migraines with gluten. I get my face pain. So it's very easy for us to stay compliant, because when we're not, we have an immediate misery. My son doesn't get immediate misery, he just gets acne a couple weeks later, and then starts having some wheezing problems. So it's a much bigger struggle for him to stay as pure on his diet as he would like to. Okay, somebody give me the time. It's about time for me to head out?
Correct time here is 10:43.
Okay, so I'm going to head off because I have to go out and see my daughter at church. Thank you all for coming. It's been, as always, a tremendous pleasure.
Thanks for listening in to Dr. Walls and Is Wheat Your Friend?